From the Department of Marketing at Deakin University, this is the Marketing Lab. My name is Paul Harrison, and I'm a senior lecturer and unit chair of marketing and consumer behaviour in the Deakin Business School at Deakin University. In this week's episode of the Marketing Lab at Deakin, I'm speaking to one of my colleagues in the Department of Marketing at Deakin Business School. Dr. Ali Tamadoni is one of our senior lecturers in the Department of Marketing, and he does research using modelling and customer analytics in areas like churn management. Clearly, you are a very prolific researcher, and you've done some very different types of research recently in very different contexts. But what is the thread that holds together your research at the moment?
I would say customer is the center of what I do. And essentially, I'm looking at this customer as the core of my research, as the center of my research from different perspectives. So generally what I try to do, I mean, the main stream of research I've had was about, you know, predicting behavior of customers in the future time. So this prediction can be, you know, in many different ways. This can be, you know, whether this customer is going to, you know, stay with the company or leave the company, or in the form of, you know, review writing behavior and word of mouth, spread of word of mouth and stuff like that. So if I look at, you know, if I look back and want to pick one thing as the core of my research, I would put, you know, customer at the center of my research and the work I do normally.
So when you say customer, you're, in a way, what you're trying to understand is customer behavior.
Exactly, yes. It's mainly about, you know, specific behaviors of customers and trying to predict that.
So what are some of those behaviors? And, you know, we can go as theoretical as you like. One of your research papers looks at churn. Can you explain to us what churn means and how you can predict that?
Yeah, essentially it's, you know, leaving or stop being a customer is called churn. So you'll have a contract with a telecom company. You just decide to, you know, terminate this contract with the company, or this contract expires. You decide not to renew it and switch to, I don't know, from Vodafone to Optus. This is basically churn. Or like in the simplest sense, I would say, like, you're buying from most of your grocery from Coles. For whatever reason, you suddenly you know the reasons, but those reasons are not, you know, known to the focal company. For some reasons, you decide to move to Aldi and spend most of your grocery spending at Aldi. So these are, you know, different types of churn in different contexts. And on the second part of the question you asked, there's been many studies around, you know, the reasons behind churn, and more like trying to establish a causal relationship between this churn behavior and factors behind churn. I'm not focusing on that part of it. I'm not saying it's not important. It's very important to understand why and what factors are driving this churn. What I'm mainly interested in is more like finding predictors. It can be, you know, coming from, you know, some sort of correlational, you know, relationship between two variables, like some factors, not necessarily the cause of the churn, that can tell us and or can be some indicators of churn and behavior of customers. Like,
so in a way, what you're saying is it's a few steps back from when they actually move.
Exactly.
When they change.
Yeah.
In a way, it allows organizations to say, when we see this certain type of attitude or behavior or whatever, we can then predict that at some point in the future, there's a high likelihood that they'll leave. Is that correct?
That's very correct. Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, once a customer has left, I mean, once we've lost this customer, it's always too late to go back to the customer and convince them to go back to come on board again. Like once I, you know, leave Vodafone, sign up a contract with Optus for 2 years, I mean, whatever, you know, offer they offer me from you know, Vodafone, I'm not going to go back to them until this new contract expires. So here we are trying to actually observe behavior of customers in different contexts. It can be in retail context, it can be in telecom context, it can be in fans of a football club even, you know, the way they buy this season ticket or attend the matches and stuff like that. These are different types of behavior by these customers. So we are trying to observe this behavior and based on that predict whether it's likely for every given customer to stop buying or terminate its relationship with the company or not in the future time.
So let's get a bit specific then. Let's think about something that you've mentioned there, which is sports fans. I'm sure that people who are listening have an interest in that. What do you need to do for a study, or how far in advance can you predict a person is going to leave, and what are some of the factors that you've discovered has an effect on their willingness to leave or not renew their season ticket?
The study we had was mainly focused on, you know, predicting behavior of these these season ticket holders for the next, I mean, for the upcoming season. So based on the behavior they had in the current season, mainly. So essentially, we need like 2 years of data to build this type of model and make this prediction. And I can say on this, some, you know, three main categories we can put them, these factors related to membership. I mean, such as number of years they've been a member of the club or number of consecutive years they've been a member of the club. These are important factors we found. I mean, these are known factors for the football clubs, of course.
And as our listeners would know in the membership episode, these are one of the strongest predictors, yeah, one of the main factors that they use to predict membership.
Exactly, yeah. And the other factor we found in, meaningful in predicting future behavior of, season ticket holders was performance of the team.
Right.
And this performance of the team is not necessarily the overall performance of the team. It's mainly, you know, number of wins for the games a given member attended. So you go to the stadium, if the team wins, that really matters on your behavior, your future behavior, or like your likelihood of renewing your season ticket for the next season.
So there's an actual effect that they continue to hold on to when they're thinking about renewing. So I'm a Richmond supporter. So if I go and see a live game and they continue to lose, that may have an effect 6 months later on my willingness to renew. Is that correct?
That's what we found. Yeah. Definitely, the overall performance of the team you support has got an impact on your decision. But the fact that you've attended like, I don't know, six games and they lost in four of them, that also matters in your decision of, you know, renewing your membership. That's what we found.
So people would say that they're not real fans. The people who give up when their team doesn't win.
Yeah, maybe that's another way of looking at it.
This is a question that you probably didn't answer, but I'm interested in your idea of, you know, we've seen with successful teams that they build up membership as well. So again, as teams become more successful, many of them have a little bit of a snowball effect and, you know, they call it the bandwagon. But this idea of people get on that bandwagon, could you say that the models could predict growth as much as it can predict reductions?
It can. I mean, we didn't look at, you know, that growth, but like, yeah, obviously growth is the opposite side of this reduction in churn. I mean, retention is the, you know, yes, the other side of, you know, churn, obviously. If something has got negative impact on churn intention, we can translate it into a factor contributing to retention, obviously.
And can you explain to us what a model is? So again, a lot of people, the words are thrown around a lot. You know, yes. We're going to use a model, and they, and right now people are very familiar with the modeling around the virus, around COVID-19 as well, and constantly. But I don't think a lot of people fully understand what a model is. So can you, in simple terms, explain to the audience what a model is?
The type of models we used are called machine learning models. In very simple words, if I want to put this, a model tries to, you know, with mathematical formulas, tries to build a relationship between your predictors. It can be, you know, number of years you've been a member, or like what we said about the ratio of wins and stuff like this. I mean, these factors, we call them predictors. A model tries to build a relationship between these factors, we call them predictors, and the outcome, which is intention to, you know, stay or like renew the contract. So first of all, we take a set of data from, like, let's say we have 1,000 club members or 10,000 club members, better to say. Out of 10,000, we focus on half of them. We try to build this relationship, build our model, or train our model in a better technical term. We train this model, and once this model is ready, we then try on predicting the retention intention or churn intention of the second half of the model, the second half of the data or members of the club. So we basically train this model on half of it and then test the performance of it on the second half of the, you know, data set we have. And that second half is called whole out sample. So for both cases, we kind of like know their real behavior. But when we are testing it, we don't give that information to the model.
Okay.
We kind of hold it to ourselves. Yeah. And then we ask the model to give us a prediction, and then we compare these to get a sense of accuracy of our model.
So when you talk about the antecedents or the predictors, who decides on these predictors?
Very good question. So in the case of... you know, like the football club, for example, the study we had there, a part of it came out of, you know, those causal studies before our study. I mean, those studies who had a focus on establishing this causal relationship between, you know, retention and some other factors. So a set of predictors came out of the, you know, those studies. So we had a look at the scientific literature. But at the same time, we had some interviews with, you know, the head of marketing of the football club we worked with. So expert opinion is very important, because like in many of the scientific studies, some factors might be missed. So we have to, you know, go through that process of, you know, talking to the experts and see, I mean, have their perspective, their view on, you know, influential factors. And and eventually, I mean, the beauty of this, you know, machine learning models is that there's no limit in terms of the variables you can introduce. And as your input variables, you can introduce whatever you want. And models kind of like, once you're training your model, it kind of like, refines the predictors and picks the one that are important.
So does it do something along the lines of, you come up with a whole bunch of predictors, antecedents, you know, it's already very abstract when you say we put it into the model. I think this is one of the things that people grapple with predictive models as well, but just models in general. You know, a model in a way is a map, or it's a means of helping you to find your way to somewhere.
Yes.
But I think one of the interesting things people grapple with is, okay, so you've decided these are the factors that you think will predict this outcome.
This outcome.
What happens in that box? What is going on in that little black box of the actual model? Is it trying stuff out? Is it going down dark? I think a lot of people, you know, mathematically these things make sense, but for a lot of people they also like to have an image in their mind of what is actually going on. So can you tell us what is actually going on in that little black box?
In that little black box, it depending on the type of model we use, we try to kind of like give an importance weight to different predictor or different factor here.
And like, do you decide on that, or does the...
We don't decide on that. So that, we let the model
as it practices, as it's training itself, it says this seems to have a much stronger effect on these things than something else. Right.
Yeah, that's
right. So it's constantly, it's constantly doing multiple experiments lots of times, very fast.
Basically, that's what a machine learning model does. It is trying to map this relationship between a set of predictors and the outcome variable here, and it does like internally does this. You know, goes through this. You know, let's call it experimental process of, you know, trying different combination of variables, see which one can best predict. And eventually it can give you, you know, some sort of importance weight of different factors. And based on that, you can decide which factor is more important than the other one. Some models can give you the models can give you the direction, whether it's got a positive effect or negative effect. But some models can only tell you about, you know, the importance weight of the factor.
Right, so a kind of correlation versus causation kind of factor.
Yeah.
So you can use it in predicting season ticket holders. Where else can you use these types of models?
I have used them in the context of churn modeling and churn prediction. I've used them in telecom context, trying to understand the behavior of users of a cell phone provider, and trying to predict their, you know, churn intention. I've used it on data from online retailers. So the way you purchase different products, like, or the way you change your behavior can be an indication of your intention to churn. But in a general sense, I can say these are predictive models and are capable of predicting any phenomenon if you have the required data for it. So now, like, it's far from this churn prediction, but the same logic, same concept can be used in other contexts. Like, in an ongoing project, I'm looking at predicting online firestorms. And by online firestorms, I mean, we have a complaint coming from a customer on a Facebook page of a brand. And depending on the number of shares and number of, you know, likes, this negative message can go viral. Not all the negative messages, not all the complaints go viral. There are many factors contributing to this, including the context of the content of the message, the reaction we get from the, you know, the company, the way they respond and handle this. And so there's a potential of every single negative message to become viral, to cause a firestorm. So the same logic, the dependent variable or the desired variable we have here is whether there is a potential for an online firestorm out of this message or not. And we're trying to understand or extract different factors and build this predictive model now in this case.
So you can predict the factors that may well lead to the firestorm or may well lead to the defection, the person not renewing their membership. And I want to come back to a few other contexts because I think that's really interesting. But the model itself doesn't tell you what you need to do. Is that right? What you need to do to prevent this happening?
Yeah.
So that's where the marketer comes in, or is it then the marketer can say, these are some of the things we could do. Can you then build a model to predict the effect of some of the things we can, the intervention, so to speak?
That's a good question. To be honest, I mean, it depends from one variable to another. I mean, some variables can give you an indication of some sort of, you know, reaction strategies, but in some cases, the variable can be just a pure indicator with no action necessarily attached to it, you know. If you're talking about, we talk about, you know, frequency of purchase can be an indication of churn, or any, you know, changes in frequency of purchase can be an indication of churn. as a marketer, you might be able to intervene or encourage this customer to purchase more, but the real cause of this reduction in, frequency of purchase might be something else. We don't know about that, and we might not be able to do anything about that. I mean, so in some cases, yeah, we can, like, to give you another example, game attendance in the case of the football clubs was a factor, you know, contributing to intention to churn. So if you buy a ticket, pay for, I don't know, like 8 games, for example, and for whatever reason you decide, I mean, it happens to you to attend only like 2 games, 3 games out of 8 available, you've already paid. So if this ratio is low, then there's lower tendency to renew this. So for some of them, for some of the members, definitely, I mean, there are ways to encourage them or remind them or something like that to push them to attend more games. But this, you know, not showing up might be coming from different factors. So
and perhaps cases, this idea, this is where the model meets, I don't know, the marketer, where you're thinking about how do we create interventions. Can you then devise a model to say, here are 6 of the things that we think will lead a person to attending more often? So to take a few steps back, you discover that your team doing badly or losing when you attend is a relatively strong predictor of not renewing. To some degree, the marketer can't change that.
That's a thing, yeah.
So that you've got a problem there. So the marketer goes, well, I have to ignore that because there's maybe what I can do is I can make plans for next year to say there's a high likelihood that we'll get less members. Let's make plans. I could imagine in the boardroom the marketer saying that and getting quite a lot of pushback. you know, what are we meant to do? But I think one of the interesting things is then, you know, in marketing we always talk about the things you can control, the things you can't. You then look at the things you can control. And so you discover that perhaps one of the bigger factors that influences, as you say, is people not coming in the first place. Is it then where you go back to the experts and you say, well, what are some of the interventions you could use, then we can build a model to look at the effect of those interventions. So is there an opportunity to understand something and then solve the problem using these types of models?
Out of these models, out of the predictor model, the main goal is to predict whether it's happening or not. And then from the outcome of the model, we can identify factors, you know, contributing to this churn behavior. But definitely you can have a follow-up study. I mean, once you have identified like attendance really matters or attending in winning games really matters, then you can sit with the experts and get their insights into how this can be used in, you know, improving retention of the members. And scientifically, if you want to measure that, the effect, so it needs a follow-up study. So the intervention comes, then we want to see how it changes the behavior of those, you know, at risk.
So you did this, we'll move on to some of your other studies in a moment, but you did this study for a football club, I'm assuming, and it was published. Did they change any of their activities as a result of your study?
We shared the outcome of this study with them. I haven't been in touch after that point, to be honest, to know what changes were approved to be made, but they are aware of the factors influencing them. I mean, obviously in those descriptive and causal studies, they already knew some of the factors, like number of years, being with the club and stuff like that. But there were some very new factors we found in our study and shared with them. Some of them can be actioned. Some of them are obviously
out of their performance of the team. What are some other ones that wouldn't normally pop up or we wouldn't
apart
be
from
surprising ones?
As I mentioned, you know, attendance in the games and, you know, performance in the general performance as well as the performance in those specific games attended are the important factors. And this can change, these important factors can change depending on the class of the ticket they have. But these are the general factors, you know, that can be applied for across all the, you know, classes of the tickets. And like in terms of marketing actions, maybe like I'm just thinking about ways to, you know, utilize these findings. I mean, like, if attendance matters and attending winning games matters, if the marketing teams knows that the marketing team knows that there's a high probability of winning a specific game, then maybe encouraging the club members, the season ticket holders, to attend those specific games can help them, you know, encourage the member base to.
You just don't want them to lose. You
know, yeah.
After encouraging 100,000 people to turn up, that's
the other side of it. Yeah.
So let's kind of talk about some of the other stuff. And I understand that so much of your work is built around modeling, but one really interesting area that you did with one of our ex-colleagues at Deakin, Reza Cassidy, as well, was around religious belief and negative word of mouth. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that research?
The idea was coming from Reza's research, to be honest, because you know, he's done a lot of work in religiosity. And the intention was to look at the word-of-mouth behavior of religious people. Is it different from normal people or not? The findings we had was more like, the first, you know, understanding I had was that normally, I personally expected religious people to be more positive when talking about experiences, when talking about, you know, even bad experiences. What we found surprisingly was that in general, religious people are more negative in terms of the word of mouth they spread.
So when you say word of mouth about
the service. Any service experience they've had.
So it's any service experience, not just
any service experience
in the context of religion, but any service experience.
No, I mean, the study we had was like, the empirical study we had was in the context of, you know, hospitality and restaurants in the US. So what we found was, that's basically a part of this study, was that in general, religious people are more negative in rating restaurants and more strict. And drilling down a bit and to understand what is causing this, we found that this is not coming from, this is basically coming from intention to help others, not, you know, taking revenge or something like that. So it's actually coming from something positive. So when a religious people experiences something bad with a service experience, it goes very, you know, very strict in rating. Maybe like an average person rates this negative experience as 3 out of 5. With high degree of religiosity, maybe that person gives it, I don't know, 2 or 1 out of 5.
And so what you're saying is it's because they have a helping attitude.
They have a helping attitude. I mean, they are willing to help others not to have the same experience. And that is why. And that is why, yeah.
Did your study look at whether they rate higher? Or is it, so it was more about negative word of mouth, but are they behaving more truthfully? Or is it really about saying we would prefer to look at the idea that we don't want people to have bad experiences, so we're going to let people know when we've had a bad experience?
It was about negative word of mouth in general. So if something negative or some issues were observed, generally religious people would rate this lower than, you know, average people or non-religious people. But on top of that, what we found was that with high degree of religiosity, if religious people are reminded of their religious beliefs, then that actually turns the effect to the opposite way. I mean, and in a way, they become more positive, even more positive than non-religious people.
Right, that's really interesting. So if they're just operating automatically, they have a tendency to go straight to what their fairness attitude, their helping attitude, which is to say, I've had a bad experience, I'd better let everybody else know that they don't want this. But then you remind them of their religiosity and they go, they overpower their natural inclination to help by giving negative word of mouth, and they say, but I'm also a religious person, so I need to be conscious of the whole context. Is that part of it? Because I guess the other factor that comes into it is that this is a business with humans as well, that they're rating negatively. So they're not helping the people in the business by giving them a one.
Yeah, I mean, the way we understood it was more like, in general, this fairness kicks in. And this fairness, I mean, it might be, I mean, still like, if they believe that the service is not at a satisfactory level, so rating it negative is still fair to their beliefs. And still they're helping others and, you know, by giving these comments and helping them not to have the same bad experience with the business. And when this priming, religious priming happens, in that case, this forgiveness sense kicks in. So that kind of like forgiveness kind of like overshadows that, you know, fairness or helpfulness type of, you know, behavior.
And how did you prime that? How did you remind people of their religiosity?
With this study, with the field study, we kind of like proxy this priming using Sundays in December. So we kind of like compared people's rating behavior on Sundays in December versus normal days in a year. And we found that effect. But in follow-up studies, lab studies, we had other types of, you know, ways of, you know, triggering this priming, including, you know, exposing them to some religious words and religious terms and stuff like that.
So a lot of the time people seem to assume that there's one thing, one big thing that affects a particular behavior. And, you know, media are constantly saying, what's the one thing that is affecting it? One of the ways that researchers try to understand something is that they say, well, there are often multiple variables, and then there are variables, things that have an effect that we may not necessarily predict are direct, or we may not necessarily believe are direct predictors of it. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to us how that role or how we test for those roles, the things that don't, that only have an effect because they go through something else?
This is what we observe in many, you know, social studies, especially like in marketing, we see these effects. Like mathematically, if you look at it from the, you know, the correlational perspective, we might find like a meaningful correlation or relationship between two variables. To give you an example, like in the case of churn, which is my area, like we might establish a meaningful relationship between satisfaction and churn. So if you look at it, we might find a direct relationship between these two. But if we drill down in theories and previous studies, we might find some other factors in between these two, you know, main factors. So
I think that's a really good way to sum it up. In between, they kind of get
exactly.
In line.
Yeah. That's why we call it mediator.
Exactly.
Yeah. Something in the middle. So satisfaction leads to this X factor in the middle, and that X factor eventually leads to that, you know, churn behavior. Like, to give you an example, I've seen many studied loyalty. So it is like a concept in between satisfaction and ultimate, you know, churn behavior that can be considered as a mediator in here. So it's basically satisfaction leading to loyalty, and that level of loyalty leading to your churn behavior or churn decision in the end.
So many businesses make the assumption that a satisfied customer will stick with them. They use satisfaction as a proxy. Why do you think businesses use satisfaction as a proxy and are unwilling to kind of fully try to understand then the other factors that come out of satisfaction?
I would say in many cases, especially in like if you look at, you know, 10 years ago, We didn't have this much data available to us to kind of like track the actual behavior of customers. I mean, we had no sense of, you know, customer databases, all these, you know, loyalty programs to gather data about customers' behavior, the actual behavior of customers. So we had to kind of like rely on perceptual and more like intention of customers, perceptual variables, I call them, to go to customers and ask them about their intentions or what they like, what they don't like. And we all know, like, when you go like and ask customers, they say something, but when it comes to the actual behavior, they might behave differently. So satisfaction is a good, you know, proxy for churn or like the actual behavior, but not a perfect predictor of that, to be honest.
And I remember a colleague of mine saying, you know, in the moment you can be satisfied, but then afterwards you can say, gee, that was a waste of money or something like that. Like a lot of the research I do is in food.
Exactly.
And you can finish a hamburger and you can feel very satisfied because it's got salt, fat, sugar. But a couple of hours later you can be going, oof, you know, I wish I hadn't eaten that. But again, you know, there are so many complexities in human behavior that we're always, as researchers, are trying to.
Exactly.
I don't think that there is any pure, I think it would be dangerous for us to say, well, we're done. We know everything now. And one of the things
that never happens in science.
It never happens in science. Exactly. But I think one of the things that we push up against as academic researchers in businesses, businesses want us to give them the answer. They want us to say, this is the correct answer. And businesses struggle a little bit with that when we go, well, this is what we know right now, so to speak. Yeah. One of the areas that you look at also is complaints and complaint recovery. Could the types of model you build also predict the complaint behavior? So when people are likely to complain and to some degree, how they might complain, so, and how that complaint might have an effect on loyalty, on satisfaction, things like that?
Potentially, yes. I mean, the study I had wasn't about predicting, complaint behavior, to be honest. It was more like using complaint and recovery of these complaints to understand, you know, intention to churn and to understand the future profitability of customers. But now that you're saying, yeah, definitely, if we have enough data, I mean, and relevant variables to build these type of models, we definitely can have, you know, complaint as our outcome and desired variable at the end of the model, and then come up with a set of predictors to predict complaint. Like, as a side study we had for that paper, we found that in retail context, if you have more perishable items in your basket, and when it comes to online orders and delivery, there's a higher likelihood of receiving complaints, for example. But there's obviously many other factors. We haven't studied them in that sense to build a sort of, you know, predictive model for that, but that definitely can be done.
So the theme of the research that we do at Deakin and this podcast to some degree is well-being. If a person has the need to complain, it means that an aspect of their well-being has been affected. When it comes to things like complaint recovery, do people feel better after that recovery if the organization does it well?
We need to study this more. The type of variables we looked at, the angle we had was more about, you know, retention and intention of customers to stay, but maybe we can use it as a proxy of, you know, satisfaction or their satisfaction with that recovery.
I think one of the things, again, we use as a, because a lot of my research is in, again, in complaints, but also from the consumer's perspective, which is well-being and fairness and those kinds of things. From an organization's perspective, their measure of a good outcome is that the customer doesn't defect, or at least they don't spread negative word of mouth. Using these types of models, is there a way that you could then say, let's take this data from the telco or take this data from the online store and help organizations to avoid people even getting to the complaint situation. Part of it might be maybe this isn't the right customer for us. Now, whether businesses would say we're not going to go after customers, that's another question. But, you know, can modelling also look at ways to avoid quite a an abstract concept like detriment, complaining behaviour, those kinds of things?
Technically, it should. We should be able to do that, to be honest. If we look at a set of data coming from these complaints and look at factors that can potentially contribute to that complaint and build a model, train a model, as I said before, on this data set, then technically we should be able to identify factors influencing these, this complaint, and from a company's perspective, preventing those things to happen.
Thanks so much for your time today, Ali. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, and I feel so much more enlightened as a result of what you've been saying about how models work, and finally I've got my head around what mediators are. So thanks so much for appearing on the Marketing Lab at Deakin.
Thank you very much, Paul. It was a pleasure for me.